It's the NPR News Update podcast. I'm Phil Picardi with the Minnesota News. Coming up this Monday, September 22nd, Democrats hope to hold the northeastern Minnesota congressional district. How are insurance companies coping with health exchanges? A look at the community school movement, a Minnesota poet in search of something, and did we see the beginning of the Teddy Bridgewater era? First, Governor Mark Dayton is announcing new measures today to combat child abuse in the wake of the death of a 4-year-old in Starbuck, Minnesota last year. Tim Nelson has more.
Eric Dean was killed by his stepmother after repeated abuse. He died 18 months ago after an assault caused serious internal injuries. His story was told in a Star Tribune report earlier this month. The story contends that authorities got more than a dozen reports that the boy was being mistreated but didn't act to save him from the abuse that ultimately killed him. His stepmother, Amanda Peltier, was convicted of murder and is serving a life sentence in prison. The case included a so-called mortality review by authorities in Pope County. That report recommended that state law allow authorities to review previous reports when deciding whether to investigate new allegations of child abuse. The governor's office says he'll announce new executive measures today and will call on the legislature to strengthen child protection measures next year. Tim Nelson, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The gold charioteer on top of the state capitol is coming down this week. Tom Scheck reports.
The Minnesota Department of Administration says it's removing the figure to repair corrosion on the statue's base. A crane will be set up on Tuesday morning to remove the charioteer and lower it to the ground. The corrosion will be repaired and the gold statue will be regilded. It's expected to take 3 months. The renovation is part of a much broader project that is underway at the state capitol. The governor's office, the state attorney general's office, legislative offices, and others have been moved from the capitol as a part of the $272 million renovation. The entire project is expected to take roughly 3 years. The golden statue, placed on the Capitol in 1906, was removed from the building in 1994 for a complete restoration and gilding. Tom Scheck, Minnesota Public Radio News.
A group called the University of Minnesota Academics United is trying to organize all faculty at the U. Here's Alex Friedrich.
The group has sent emails asking university faculty members to authorize the Service Employees International Union to represent them. U of M sociology professor David Pello says he supports letting the union help negotiate wages, benefits, and working conditions. He says many faculty work 60 to 70 hours a week, including teaching, grading, advising students, and conducting research.
There is so much work that professors do both inside and outside of class that I think is, and frankly, mysterious to a lot of people.
University officials say the group needs to ensure that it complies with state laws regarding organizing. Alex Friedrich, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota and the Children's Home Society celebrated milestone anniversaries in St. Paul over the weekend. Elizabeth Baer has details.
This year marks the 125th anniversary for the Children's Home Society, and next year, Lutheran Social Service will celebrate its 150th anniversary. Jody Harpstead is CEO of both organizations that have a combined adoption service. She says the pastor who launched what is now the Children's Home Society wanted to make sure families weren't turning children into indentured servants.
So when he created the Children's Home Society, he told parents that they expected the children to get 2 new suits a year, just like their other children, to be sent to school and then to be taken great care of throughout their lives.
About 46,000 children have found families through adoption in Minnesota as a result of both organizations. The agencies still do about 300 adoptions each year. Elizabeth Baer, Minnesota Public Radio News, Rochester.
Not long ago, Minnesota's 8th Congressional District was considered a DFL stronghold, but that's starting to change, and Democrats say they cannot take the northeastern part of the state for granted anymore. This year, Democrats and their allies are making a big push to turn out voters in the area. Catherine Richard has the story.
If there's one part of the state that's most important to DFL party chair Ken Martin this election year, it's the 8th Congressional District. DFL Congressman Rick Nolan is in a tough race with Republican Stuart Mills. And Democrats need to protect key legislative seats to keep control of the Minnesota House. On top of all of that, Martin has to make sure Governor Mark Dayton and Senator Al Franken do well on the Iron Range so they can win statewide.
You have this rare sort of confluence of all of these things coming together that make the 8th probably, you know, ground zero for Democrats this year.
The 8th district stretches from the northern Twin City suburbs to the Canadian border and west to Bemidji. The party will spend an unprecedented amount of money in the area this fall. Martin won't say exactly how much, but it will pay for a barrage of mailers, phone calls, television ads, and an extensive door-knocking campaign. Republicans won't make winning easy for Democrats. State Republican Chair Keith Downey says his party has a new voter outreach strategy to make sure more Republicans show up on Election Day. But Downey also sees long-term opportunity to change the area's political alliances by turning a rift between Democrats over copper-nickel mining into a chasm. Republicans have made the issue central to their campaign. It's a message tailored to Democrats who want more jobs in the area.
When you talk about mining, it's really a poster child for a lot of different issues. The focus on jobs, the focus on an economy that's fundamentally rooted in, you know, all these things that Minnesota has based its economy on in the past.
Martin is preoccupied with the 8th's long-term political landscape, too, but for a different reason. He says the area's shifting demographics mean northeastern Minnesota has become more difficult for Democrats to win. As jobs decline, younger people have moved away, and older supporters eventually die. Meanwhile, the southern part of the district is increasingly conservative. So that's why Martin has a plan to start competing in southern and western Minnesota, where the DFL hasn't been as strong in the past.
Hi.
On a September evening, Elisa Erickson is pounding on doors in a Cambridge, Minnesota subdivision of modest homes and perfect lawns. Erickson works for Take Action Minnesota, one of several political groups helping Democrats win in the 8th. When Tracy Epple opens her door, Erickson gets right to her pitch for Dayton and Nolan.
There's a lot that our elected officials can do to improve the economic security of women and families in Minnesota. Things like raising the minimum wage.
Yep. Also allowing employees to earn paid sick time.
Epple is going back to work for the first time in nearly a decade, so earned sick time gets her attention.
Where I'm going to work is where I worked before I had kids, when one of the moms then would call and say, my kid is sick or whatever, and they were not very nice about it. So I'm like, I hope that's changed a little bit now that I'm going back to work.
Epple says she will vote for Dayton and Nolan. And if she seems like an easy sell, that's by design. Erickson's visit is part of Take Action's finely tuned strategy to target thousands of middle class women who respond positively to messages about economic security. In an election that will be won by candidates who get the most supporters to show up at the polls, Erickson is just motivating Epple to vote. But like Ken Martin, Take Action Minnesota's executive director Dan McGrath is concerned with the 8th District's political future. He says keeping the area blue will mean engaging people even after the election is over. McGrath's group recently opened offices in Duluth and Grand Rapids to do just that.
The way to, I think, grab hold of voters is to look to the future and keep saying, what else needs to happen?
McGrath says Take Action doesn't uniformly support DFL party priorities and candidates, but where the two overlap, McGrath says his group is ready to turn out volunteers on the party's behalf. Catherine Richert, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Minsure says it will reveal next year's premium rates in early October. People can start signing up for coverage on the state's insurance exchange about a month later. Those new rates will get a lot of attention, especially after the insurer with the lowest prices and most customers on Minsure announced last week that it's dropping out of the exchange. Preferred One said selling insurance through Minsure is not sustainable, but the company has refused to explain further, and that's left observers wondering if Preferred One was not charging enough. Caroline Pearson is a vice president at Avalier Health, a consulting firm. She joined Kathy Werzer this morning.
Given the experience at Preferred One in Minnesota, we learned that buyers seem to favor the lowest price plan, so the need to keep your prices low appears to be important. But did that strategy contribute to Preferred One's problems?
Well, that is certainly what we would guess based on what we know right now. Health insurers going into the market in 2014 were really operating in an information vacuum. They really didn't know exactly who the populations were that were going to sign up for the exchanges. And they didn't know a lot about what their medical spending patterns would be. So they were trying to price products without enough information, and they knew they had to price low, as you said, to attract enrollment. So it's possible that Preferred One really just priced a little too low in this case.
To work well, as you know, an insurer needs a mix of healthy clients to balance out those who are sickest. Might insurers, in an effort to attract young people who are usually healthy, use this low price strategy? Do we see that with exchanges this year?
Yeah, that's definitely the case. The insurers knew that they needed to attract the healthier individuals who were going to expect to have lower health spending, and those are going to be the people who are going to be the most price sensitive because they're the least likely to get the benefit out of having a really deluxe premium insurance product. So they wanted to price low and attract those young enrollees, but there's a lot of factors at play in determining whether young healthy people were going to sign up, and so ultimately making sure that risk pool is balanced between some of the sicker folks and some of the healthier folks was probably critical to the business outcome for these plans.
So now that these folks are in the house, as it were, can some of these plans raise rates?
The plans do have the option to raise rates. There's some federal restrictions on how much rates can be raised without triggering some additional review. But if plans are raising rates and can justify that their costs really support those rate increases, they do have the opportunity to raise them. Interestingly, what we've seen in some other states is some of the largest carriers who also priced plans most affordably in 2014 are similarly taking relatively large rate increases for 2015. So we're seeing rate increases around 9 or 10% in many of the largest health plans in the exchange markets.
In that case, could Preferred One simply have raised its rates instead of dropping out?
It seemingly they could have, and it'll be interesting as we start to uncover a little bit more about the business decision that supported this. Previously, prior to the launch of MinSure, the Preferred One had a very limited participation in the individual market. They were a small player in that market, and so they may have just decided that this was too high risk and not a market that they really wanted to prioritize for their overall strategy.
Did it surprise you that Preferred One dropped out?
It did surprise me. This is one of the only cases that we've seen of this in the exchanges. In other states, we're actually seeing a lot of health insurers enter the market and newly try to compete because of such success that we've seen in 2014.
Well, now with some experience with exchanges, what factors are insurers going to keep looking at when deciding what to charge?
Well, they're going to start to have a lot better information about the health status, and ultimately that's going to be the number one factor is really what do we know about the people that are in the market and what do we expect their medical costs to be over the course of the year. But there's many other things at play too. Really, it all has to do with competition. As you mentioned, for plans to win enrollment, they really need to be the lowest cost or one of the lowest cost offerings. We saw that people really selected those low-cost plans, and so there's a competitive element here, and carriers need to determine whether they think other plans are going to enter the market and try to undercut them on price, because that's going to drive decision-making too.
Can you still be a low-cost insurer with an aging population with more chronic disease?
Well, they're going to have to figure out a way to do that, because increasingly we're seeing consumers demanding low-cost products, and I think plans are really needing to be innovative in the way that they structure their physician and hospital networks, as well as the way that they think about managing diseases and setting cost sharing to really try to reduce overall healthcare spending and support those low premiums.
Caroline Pearson, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much.
That conversation on Morning Edition. There's a small movement across the country to turn schools into more than just a place to learn. Advocates say adding services such as healthcare, parenting classes, and community events will help people in underserved communities engage more with their schools, and that, the theory goes, will help close the achievement gap between white students and students of color. In Minnesota, the idea has gotten a toehold in Brooklyn Center, where district officials say the model is helping improve the health of students and better engage in the community. But state data on test scores shows that so far student achievement has been mixed. Tim Post reports.
12-year-old Charles Greaves, a 7th grader at Brooklyn Center Arts and IB School, had a recent run-in with a football.
So my friend, he was throwing it to the person I was supposed to guard. Then I tried intercepting it, then it hit my eye and bounced in the air.
today's got a little bit of a red spot in it, and so the nurse sent him down. It was pretty watery, and there was a spot. So we just wanted to make sure everything was okay.
That's Dr. Amy Boniface, a physician with Park Nicollet Health Services. Boniface was able to give Greaves a clean bill of health here at a clinic in the school and send him back to class.
Now, this is a fully functioning clinic. We've got 3 exam rooms. We can get through 15 to 18 kids in an afternoon.
There's also an eye clinic, a mental health clinic, and a dental clinic in this space. School officials converted 2 classrooms into the clinic in 2009. The $250,000 cost was covered by the Park Nicollet Foundation. The clinic provides free health care to students in this school and any child in the Brooklyn Center School District. Patrice Howard is the Brooklyn Center School District's community school manager. She says not only are students now spending less time at off-campus doctor visits, they're also more likely to get the health care they need, and that translates into fewer absences. In 2009, there were more than 9,000 absences in the district's high school. Last year, there were fewer than 6,500. Howard also credits the school's health clinic and services like tutoring and before and after school programs for pushing up the reading scores for English learners and special education students in recent years.
We know that the things that we're doing are helping, and we do attribute to a lot of our co-located services and our partnerships.
But it doesn't appear that the full-service community school model has improved overall test scores in the district. Math and reading scores are 20 points lower than the state average and have dipped in the last 2 years. And a gap of more than 15 percentage points separates the reading and math test scores of white students and black students. Joe Nathan is director of the St. Paul-based Center for School Change. In 2007, Nathan wrote a report on schools that collaborate with outside organizations.
The ways that it tends to help youngsters are not necessarily going to show up in test scores or graduation rates. Sometimes they will, sometimes they won't. But if your goal is just to improve standardized test scores or graduation rates, this isn't necessarily going to produce that result.
Nathan says that doesn't mean full-service community schools aren't a good idea. The services they provide result in healthier kids and more stable families. And he says they help schools and community organizations save money by sharing spaces and resources. Marty Blank, director of the Coalition for Community Schools in Washington, D.C., says that's a hallmark of the schools.
By creating the school as the place where they can all work together, we are really leveraging existing resources and using them much more efficiently.
Blank points to many community school success stories across the country, schools that turned around test scores and narrowed the achievement gap between white students and students of color. He says there are about 6,000 community schools in the country, a number he'd like to see double in coming years. In Minnesota, outside of the Brooklyn Park District, there are a handful of community schools, all with slightly different approaches. Education officials say more schools across the state are now talking about partnering with local organizations and adopting the full-service model. Tim Post, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Writer Jim Lenfesty has traveled many paths over the years. He's been a journalist, a teacher, and also served on the editorial board of the Star Tribune. But foremost, he sees himself as a poet. UN Care reports Lenfesty did not realize until recently he was a poet in search of something.
If a journey of 1,000 miles starts with a single step, then Jim Lenfesty took that step in a bookstore back in 1970. He says the owner knew him well.
One day I walked in there and he handed me this book. He said, "Here, try these." And he handed it to me like a doctor giving a prescription to a patient.
It was a collection of poems by the Chinese poet Han Shan, who is said to have lived in a cave.
All we know about this character was that he wrote some 300 poems. He painted them on rocks and walls and carved them on trees about 1,200 years ago in the Tang Dynasty of China.
The poems survived thanks to a local government official. He liked them and copied them down. It was modern translations of those ancient works that Lenfesty held in his hand.
Well, I fell in love.
Not only did he read the poems to himself, he read them to friends, students, anyone who would listen.
But here's the thing. That was 1970. So in 2005, I'm still reading them. This has never happened to me. You know, I think this happens to everybody. There's one artist, or there's one sculptor, there's one painter, there's one author that seems to speak to them in a way they don't understand. And this was the case for me.
He recites one of his favorites.
Here we languish, a bunch of poor scholars ravaged by extremes of hunger and cold. Out of work, our only joy is poetry. Scribble, scribble, we wear out our brains. Who will read the works of such men? On that point, you can save your sighs. We could inscribe our poems on biscuits, and homeless dogs wouldn't deign to nibble.
Jim Lanfasti describes the poem as a 1,200-year-old joke.
But it's also, it turns out, the most wonderful tonic for a writer.
A writer who wonders if a word they write will ever be read.
I recite that poem all the time to people saying, take heart. Here's the guy complaining about nothing going on for literature 1,200 years ago, and here I am 1,200 years later reciting it to you.
It was this ongoing fascination with Hans Schön which ultimately led Lanfasti to go on a literary pilgrimage to try to find the cave where the poet lived.
This was a deep response to a deep call that I couldn't understand and I had to pursue. And so it led me not only to the specific cave in China and to around China, but it led me into a whole study of a culture. There are many, many more things that deepened and deepened and deepened. And then, of course, it led me to help me understand more about myself.
Jim Lanfasti has chronicled what happened in a new book called Seeking the Cave. He'll launch it tonight at Plymouth Congregational Church in Minneapolis at 7 p.m. The book is a memoir of the trip, but also contains poems Lanfasti wrote inspired by the journey. It's taken him 7 years since he returned from China to sort through everything. He reads one of the poems.
I have traveled enough in this world. I have heard the eternal cicada's song, language of the temple, the court, the heart. Now, wherever I travel, there I am. When I sit, my mind sits too. When I dance, the air around me dances. When I die, I feed the earth that fed me.
It's beautiful.
Thank you, even though I missed a word.
I didn't notice. I didn't
when I dance, the air around me whirls.
Jim Lanfasti says after traveling thousands of miles, he's come to a realization. Seeking the cave was both a literal and a metaphorical journey, and he believes he's discovered himself. Ewan Kerr, Minnesota Public Radio News.
We go back to Kathy Werzer in Morning Edition to finish off the podcast. Vikings quarterback Matt Cassel broke his foot in yesterday's loss. So did we see the dawning of the Teddy Bridgewater era? Kathy asked Star Tribune digital sports editor Howard Sinker.
How serious is the injury to Mr. Cassel?
I think it's serious enough that I would assume that we're not going to see Matt Cassel for the rest of the season. Even if he was ready to play with a few weeks left, I suspect that Teddy Bridgewater's career will be far enough down the road that the Vikings are going to want to stay with him.
Now, for folks who are not following this, Teddy Bridgewater is a rookie quarterback. And that has to be a lot of pressure on this young man.
Well, it is a lot of pressure. I think this is something that was going to happen eventually at some time this season. And Cassel hadn't been playing particularly well before he broke his foot during the second quarter of Sunday's game. And looking at the schedule, if he had continued to play poorly, I think that Bridgewater probably would have been starting, a couple games down the road. There's a game on October 12th against Detroit that I'm guessing that, without saying as much, the Vikings may have been targeting. But the injury kind of changes the game plan.
So the Vikings lost 20-9, but did Bridgewater look okay?
I would say he looked decent under the circumstances. New Orleans is a good team that had lost its first two games and was going to do everything possible not to lose a third. Playing in New Orleans at the Superdome is always daunting. It was decidedly okay. And I think with a week of practice, the Vikings coaches will be able to prepare specifically for Bridgewater playing quarterback, and you'll see an offense that's probably a little bit different than it had been the first few weeks of the season.
All right. Might the offense improve possibly with Teddy Bridgewater?
Well, I don't know if it'll improve right away, but down the road, the expectation is that he will be a superior quarterback to the guys who've been playing the position for the last few years. That's why he was a first-round draft choice.
Well, the loss, of course, capped off a pretty bad week for the Vikings. Do you think the team is missing Adrian Peterson?
Well, of course they're missing Adrian Peterson, but that's got to be getting further and further in the rearview mirror. I just don't see any scenario in which he plays for the Vikings again this year or maybe ever again, although I just don't want to get into thinking about that at this particular time. More pressing, I think, in addition to Castle's injury, though, Kathy, is a couple other key players were hurt yesterday. Kyle Rudolph, the tight end, suffered a groin injury that will be further evaluated today, and one of their offensive linemen, right guard Brandon Fusco, suffered a shoulder injury. And the Vikings don't have a lot of depth on the offensive line, and that may be an issue, and even more so with Bridgewater moving into the starting lineup next Sunday against Atlanta.
Wow, it sounds like the Vikings are leaking a little oil here.
They're leaking a little oil. Keep in mind, though, that nobody expected this to be a great season to begin with. So if it becomes a developmental season, I don't think that people have a lot to complain about in terms of expectations that won't be met.
Mm. By the way, how tough is Atlanta?
Atlanta's pretty darn tough. They won 56-14 last Thursday. They're a high-powered offensive machine with a decent defense. So even if the Vikings don't win, it'll be a fun day because it'll be Bridgewater's first start. It'll be here in town, and it could be a fun game. Just don't get your hopes up too high.
All right. I will talk to you later this week. Thanks much.
Have a great week, Kathy.
Werzer and Sinker on Morning Edition, and for us here on the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. I'm Phil Picardi. I'll be back with the Tuesday news.